We intend to arrest the decline and fill the pipeline within 10 years.
Governor Parnell wants 1 million barrels of oil a day flowing through TAPS. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, June 28th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, a new assessment finds huge natural gas reserves in Cook Inlet.
Big question is going to be how much of that is economically recoverable.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by
Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for over 50 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. Crowley.com.
The State House today rejected a bill to extend the state's coastal management program. The measure passed by the Senate late yesterday failed on an 18-18 vote in the House. But the final action is moot, as Governor Sean Parnell said today. He'd veto the measure if necessary.
Well, I can say with certainty that the bill that the Senate passed yesterday, that 11 senators passed, will kill jobs and kill projects because it assumes that the existing office can handle incoming applications at a rate of about 100 applications per month. So the answer is I do not support that bill as passed by the Senate last night. I would veto it. I mean, when I say I don't support something, that means I don't support it in that form, and that's where we are.
APRN's Dave Donaldson has this report on the action today at the Capitol.
The governor's statement took the suspense out of the final floor action, since the result was no longer in question. The coastal management program would go away. All day long, through 3 hours of finance committee hearings and a one-hour closed-door majority caucus, the question was, would the bill get enough support to move it out of committee so the entire House could vote on it? The committee spent the morning listening to Attorney General John Burns and Commissioner of Environmental Conservation Larry Hardig. The two told the committee that the Parnell administration has already gone so far in taking down the coastal management program that it could not be revived. Burns used the term decimated in describing the condition of the offices and the five employees still on the job. That's the same thing Governor Parnell had been telling legislators yesterday and today, before he said he would veto the bill. At the end of the day, if committee members had voted their personal feelings, the bill would have died then. As several members explained, they were only voting to move the question to a debate by the full membership on the floor. They were not supporting the bill. And in signing the bill, after the meeting, six committee members recommended do not pass. Only three supported it. In explaining the bill to the full House on the floor, Anchorage Republican Mike Hawker said, "The measure is a final step toward reaching finality on the coastal management program." I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
Governor Parnell outlined an ambitious program to get the state's economy moving at the annual meeting of the Resource Development Council in Anchorage today. Parnell wants to arrest oil decline and move 1 million barrels of oil a day through the Trans-Alaska pipeline system in the next decade.
Our great goal of 1 million barrels of oil flowing through TAPS within 10 years. We intend to arrest the decline and fill the pipeline within 10 years.
The governor criticized the federal government for turning on the Strategic Oil Reserve tap.
We have to demonstrate a better option. Here in Alaska, we have a solution to the nation's foreign oil dependency. It's called American oil. It's oil from Alaska, it's oil from Wyoming, it's oil from Texas. We don't have to keep tapping the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. We don't have to keep being dependent upon foreign sources of oil to the extent we are. We can produce here at home.
Parnell's plan to get domestic production rolling in Alaska is highlighted in a Secure Alaska's Future Initiative, OIL, which is setting its sights on five targets, among them boosting the state's competitiveness and investment climate.
We will continue to aggressively pursue tax changes to make this state more competitive and to grow more jobs at home.
Other aspects of the program include facilitating the next phase of North Slope oil development. Part of that plan involves improving infrastructure access and lowering costs of resource development. Parnell said the budget he'll sign this week assures that.
Those budget bills will include $8 million to finish environmental work, for a 90-mile transportation corridor from the Dalton Highway to Umiak. That will open up a lot more of Alaska's land. It will also include $43 million for the Dalton Highway so that we can demonstrate to our people and to America that our lifeline to Alaska's and America's energy production will be maintained safely.
Parnell also wants to reduce the backlog of water and land use permit applications by hiring more workers in the permitting area. The governor also stressed the importance of forging national partnerships to facilitate increased exploration and investment in oil in the state. The federal government says there are huge amounts of undiscovered natural gas reserves in Cook Inlet. The United States Geological Survey assessment finds almost 10 times the amount that was estimated in 1995, but it's unclear whether any of that gas will eventually reach South Central consumers. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
If 19 trillion cubic feet of natural gas doesn't mean much to you, Joe Balash, the deputy commissioner at the Department of Natural Resources, can put it in perspective. He says he knew there was a lot of gas in Cook Inlet, but the size of this new assessment surprised him.
Yeah, that's a big number. That's a really big number.
For context, Balash says Prudhoe Bay, the largest oil and gas field in North America, has 24 trillion cubic feet. With gas well supplies dwindling in Cook Inlet, that new number is especially important. But that huge amount doesn't mean much if companies don't develop it. Rick Stanley helped produce the new assessment for USGS. He says this report doesn't change the fact that developing reserves in Cook Inlet isn't easy.
There hasn't been much exploration going on for a variety of reasons. It's very expensive to drill in Cook Inlet. It's a rather difficult environment compared to other drilling environments around the world, and it's very expensive.
Stanley says Cook Inlet is remote. It's a tricky subarctic environment, and the huge tides and ice make it difficult to engineer offshore platforms. The assessment looked at technically recoverable oil and gas reserves, but Joe Balash agrees it's unclear how much of that gas is economically recoverable. The utilities in South Central need gas, but they don't necessarily need enough of it to convince companies to fund exploration.
The big question is going to be, you know, whether or not there is a big enough market locally to attract the kind of investment in exploration needed to go and fully explore Cook Inlet.
Still, Balash sees hopeful signs. He says two companies have drilled promising exploration wells in the last year, and he's optimistic they could have commercial arrangements in place relatively quickly.
And we've seen some exploration activity taking place here recently, true exploration, and understand that those companies have met with some success. How much success? Is yet to be determined.
But the utilities in the region can't wait to see whether new gas wells will be developed in the inlet. They're working on contingency plans for importing liquid natural gas to South Central. Balash calls the cost of building an LNG import facility extraordinary, and he says it would be difficult for customers to pay the high cost of buying gas from far away when there's such a huge resource close to home. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, reality TV's love affair with Alaska continues with a jet ski ride to Petersburg.
It's been a huge adventure for sure. We almost lost a ski, rolled a ski in Big Surf, right up against the rocks.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for over 30 years.
NASA may be shutting down its manned spaceflight program, but it's increasing its presence in a place that's almost as foreign to most humans, the Arctic. KUCB's Alexandra Gutierrez reports that the agency is wrapping up its first oceanographic mission, IceScape.
After setting up their labs and securing their equipment, about 50 NASA scientists left on Alaska for the Arctic to complete the second phase of the IceScape mission. The team is working to get a better picture of why sea ice is rapidly disappearing in the Beaufort and Chukchi Seas. While IceScape is an Earth science mission, there is a space component too. co-chief scientist Don Perovich says their research will be used alongside data collected by NASA's satellites.
The best way to see the big picture is from space. But what you have to do is every so often check to see what's going on the surface.
Since scientists first began measuring the ice cover in the Arctic in 1979, it shrunk dramatically, about 30%. That's like if
the entire United States east of the Mississippi melted away, plus that column of states from Minnesota all the way down to Louisiana melted, plus North Dakota, plus part of South Dakota.
And according to some icecape scientists, like Karen Fry, it's only going to get worse.
There are models out there right now that say, on average, there is an expectation that by the year 2037, we will have no sea ice in the Arctic, summertime whatsoever. So what that essentially means is that we will no longer have multi-year perennial sea ice. So the remnants that we may see when we're up there may be some of the last remnants of multi-year ice that we may see, certainly in my lifetime.
While aboard the Coast Guard icebreaker Healy, these scientists will be conducting a wide variety of studies on the Arctic's biology and chemistry. They'll be measuring how thick the ice is and how much light passes through it. They'll also spend time trying to figure out how climate change affects the food web and what that means for animals like whales and polar bears that rely on a consistent food production cycle, says Chief Scientist Kevin Arrigo.
The worry is that things are going to miss the boat. You know, they're going to be there and the peak has already happened and the food is gone, and what are they going to do? And that's a trend that seems to be continuing.
And that impacts subsistence hunters in the region.
It's the indigenous communities and it's the subsistence hunters that really have their daily lives affected by this. I mean, there are indigenous communities now that look at these sea ice maps in order to understand how much gasoline they need to purchase for their fishing boats to get out to the ice edge.
The NASA scientists expect to start publishing their conclusions from the IceGate mission over the next 2 years, but the voyage itself will wrap up in Seward in 5 weeks. In Unalaska, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
One of Alaska's most prominent educators is retiring after nearly four decades of working with students in the state's largest city. Anchorage School District Superintendent Carol Como says she is stepping down from the high-profile post she has held since 2000. Her last day will be June 30th of next year. The 69-year-old Como made the announcement today in Anchorage. She has worked for the school district since 1974, serving in various capacities, including aide, teacher, principal, and central office administrator. She was president of the Anchorage Teachers Union in 1984 and 1985. Como stepped in as acting superintendent when former superintendent Bob Crystal resigned suddenly because of controversy about his new contract. Title 21 rewrite project covering land development and building requirements is not on this evening's Anchorage Assembly agenda, but that's not to say Title 21 won't be drawing a group of interested, if silent, citizens. KSKA's Len Anderson explains.
The project to rewrite the portion of a municipal code dealing with commercial, industrial, residential, and multi-use development began in 2002. Since then, there have been five drafts, scores of public meetings and hearings, along with years of weekly Assembly Title 21 committee meetings. The goal is to make the code more consistent with the sweeping vision for the city as expressed in the comprehensive plan, Anchorage 2020. By last summer, 13 of 14 sections or chapters had been provisionally adopted by the Anchorage Assembly. Chugiak, Eagle River, and Girdwood are separate chapters. Also last summer, Mayor Dan Sullivan contracted with former Assembly member Dan Coffey to work on possible amendments to the provisional version. Coffey is a commercial property owner who's also served on Anchorage's Planning and Zoning Commission. He generally reflects views closer to developers and commercial property owners. His contract ends July 1st. Dissatisfaction over the Coffey contract has grown among some groups who have backed what they see as the code's quality of life issues. Several filed requests to formally address the Anchorage Assembly at tonight's meeting. Cindy Carnes of Eagle River was one. Carnes says her request, like others, was denied by Assembly Chair Debbie Osiander.
All our responses came back the same, and that was, Assembly isn't dealing with Title 21 right now. The mayor has it in his office. Thank you for your interest in this endeavor. That's the kind of the response. It wasn't really a denial, but I see that we're not on the agenda either.
Carnes will attend tonight's meeting to protest her silent status. Former Assemblymember Sheila Selkrig was another who unsuccessfully requested to speak. A former member of the Assembly's Title 21 Committee, she says the immediate issue is not Coffey's proposed amendments per se, but the process which created them. Selkrig adds the provisionally approved Title 21 chapters are already a compromise between various parties. Thus, further revisions should come to a fully approved code.
Have the Assembly act on the provisionally approved chapters and approve them along with the revisions that the Planning Department has recommended to make them kind of functionally work together. And then if the Mayor has some amendments, to bring those amendments forward one by one.
Oceana responds that, first of all, how the Mayor creates his proposed amendments lies beyond Assembly control. And she says provisional means just that. Amendments can still be put forward before final passage as long as they follow procedure.
All proposed amendments will go through the Planning and Zoning Commission, then to the Assembly Title 21 Committee, and then to the Assembly for adoption.
Oceander says before the mayor's amendments go to the commission, she'll have them posted on the municipal website. The commission's consideration begins the public comment possibilities, which continues through eventual assembly consideration.
There will be multiple opportunities for folks to testify, to provide as detailed a comment as they like.
But not tonight. When does Oceander expect those amendments to come under full assembly consideration?
My guess is actually the beginning of next year.
That's a long wait for those who feel the Title 21 changes are ready for final approval now. Tonight's Anchorage Assembly meeting begins at 5 p.m. with the public appearance portion scheduled for sometime after 6 o'clock, but before 7. Individuals can also address the Assembly on non-agenda items just before the meeting's adjournment. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
The Taylor Highway is open again after a washout and slide made two sections of the road impassable. The State Department of Transportation reports that repairs have been completed at mile 83 near Chicken, where a creek cut into the roadbed, and between mileposts 114 and 116 on the way to Eagle, where a slide came down. DOT spokeswoman Meadow Bailey says the slope is a trouble spot where a major slide blocked the road for an extended period last summer.
It's a very steep slope, and after it slid last year, the roots haven't been able to reestablish themselves, and so it's not 100% stable yet. And when there's a large influx of rain, we just get some dirt and trees that slide down on the road, so we had to clear that out.
Last summer, the state spent millions of dollars repairing the Taylor Highway following heavy rains that resulted in numerous slides and washouts, closing sections of the road for much of the summer. Alaska's U.S. senators are weighing in on a controversial update to Juneau's floodplain maps. City officials have asked the Federal Emergency Management Agency to delay the update, citing concerns over the map's accuracy, as well as a lack of notice on FEMA's 90-day public comment period, which ended on Friday. Senators Lisa Murkowski and Mark Begich today wrote letters to FEMA officials backing the city's request for a 30-day extension of the comment period. Juneau's floodplain maps were last updated in 1990. A FEMA consultant prepared new maps last year, which put a number of new properties in areas deemed at risk for floods. CBJ Community Development Director Dale Pernula says the city is concerned that Juneau residents will be forced to buy unneeded flood insurance as a result.
From our point of view, we want to have the maps accurate more than anything else.
If FEMA does not grant an extension, the agency would deliver the finalized maps to the city this fall. The Juneau Assembly would then have 6 months to adopt them.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. How do you get men to wear their life jacket when the fact is that 90% of boating-related fatalities in Alaska are men? Well, truthfully, most men won't listen to messages like this, but they might listen to you. Have them fill out a Pledge to Live card and make a promise to wear their life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time. Get a Pledge to Live card at pledgetolive.org. Make them promise so they make it back alive. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
Investors are spending upwards of $1 million a month on mineral exploration at the Niblack mine on the southern end of Prince of Wales Island. If exploration continues to go well, British Columbia-based Heatherdale Resources hopes to begin construction on the mine in 2015. KRBD's Deanna Garrison has this report.
Speaking before a Ketchikan Chamber of Commerce luncheon on Wednesday, Heatherdale CEO Patrick Smith gave an update on the Niblack mine. Smith says the project is in the advanced exploration stage with an estimated 6.6 million tons of gold, copper, zinc, and silver identified.
6.6 million tons. If we mine like Greens Creek at about 2,000 tons per day, this provides about a 10-year mine life.
Of the minerals found, Smith says a good portion are considered higher grade.
Within that 6.6 million tons, we've got a nice sweet spot of about 1.5 million tons of very nice grade. And so that is the plum in the pudding that might allow us to get, when we start mining, to get that early payback of your capital, because capital expense on something like this, it will be in the order of $200 million or so.
He says the company is operating 3 drill rigs at the site, 2 underground and 1 above ground. Smith expects Heatherdale to initiate more advanced scoping studies toward the end of this year. He says permitting could begin in 2013, with construction starting as soon as 2015. Despite positive findings so far, Smith says Heatherdale is not ready to commit to developing the mine.
We still have a lot to do before we know whether this will be truly economic and truly conformable to where we are, what we have to do, permitting, the whole nine yards. So we're still several years away from saying, hey, this is a go.
He says most of the development would be underground, although some tailings from the mine would be kept above ground. Smith says the company has looked at a variety of mineral processing options. He says that includes shipping the ore somewhere else for processing.
The thing at Niblack, where it is, it's power intensive to mill. And so you have to have a diesel power generation facility if you don't have anything else to deal with. Well, diesel power, as you know, is rather expensive.
Smith regularly compared the Niblack project to the Greens Creek mine near Juneau. Like Greens Creek, the Niblack would produce around 2,000 tons a day. Smith says Niblack would likely employ around the same number of people as Greens Creek. He says Greens Creek employs around 340 workers, producing a total of 530 direct and indirect jobs. The average wage at Greens Creek is $91,000 a year. In Ketchikan, I'm Deanna Garrison.
Family and friends welcomed the cast and crew of a new reality TV show as they pulled their jet skis up to the dock in Petersburg's North Harbor on a recent afternoon. 3 of the 5 cast and crew members have ties to Petersburg, and the group plans to film along the coast of Alaska for the next few weeks. KFSK's Jovic Nicky reports.
Oh, they're coming!
The 3 cast members and 2 on the camera crew pulled up to the dock on 4 Sea-Doo jet skis after 1,400 miles in 5 days from Seattle to Petersburg. Stephen Mall is executive producer and a member of the cast.
It's been a huge adventure for sure. We almost lost a ski. I mean, rolled a ski in big surf right up against the rocks, thought it was going to splinter. We had a ski breakdown we had to repair in Port Hardy down in British Columbia. And this is just the beginning. You know, this is just the first step getting to Petersburg.
Maul came through Southeast Alaska on a jet ski last year and broke down in Frederick Sound at near Five Finger Lighthouse. He was towed back to Petersburg and met local resident Charles Davis, who helped repair the jet ski and eventually joined on with the show. Davis's brother Wesley is driving the camera ski, and another former Petersburg resident, Andrew Mazzella, rides on the back of the camera ski filming the trip. He says it's been a learning experience.
We're pioneering something, you know, and, you know, there's a lot that goes with that. So we're figuring it out and working out the kinks The farther south, the better, before we get up into the real nasty stuff. So.
The riders say the skis can cruise at speeds as high as 60 to 65 miles an hour, but they're most fuel efficient around 42 miles an hour. The group is making some modifications in Petersburg to boost the fuel capacity of the watercraft and hope eventually to be able to travel up to 350 miles between refueling stops. The group has already had some excitement on the first part of their trip. Charles Davis describes coming through Dixon Entrance on a jet ski.
We're hitting about 4 to 6 footers, and sometimes you can get clipping along 25, 35 mile an hour. I actually had one instance where I come off a wave, crash down at the bottom, probably going too fast up the other, cut the next wave, and I had about a foot and a half of blue water over the top of the ski, washed me clean off my ski. And so I'm just out there, Bob, just swimming for my ski as fast as I can. And we kind of got it handed to us in the Dixon Entrance a little bit, but we did all right.
Davis says another exciting moment came while playing around a rock in the surf on the British Columbia coastline.
And we were catching some big air around this rock, and I come around, and I'm looking at the waves running up the side of this rock, and I'm thinking, you know, I bet I could ride up over that rock and come back down on the surf before it goes dry. And as I was kind of scoping it out, I was a little ways from the rock. I had it, the water just started dropping out from underneath me, and I could see the rock down below. And I just started racing out of there, and just about the time I got to the top of the wave, it broke over the top of my ski and rolled me over in the surf.
Cameraman Andrew Mazzella jumped off another ski and helped Davis flip his ski upright again and get away from the crashing waves. The reality TV show will be following the travels of the three ski riders as they tour the country. The crew plans 6 weeks of filming this summer along the coast of Alaska. Here's Maul on the show's website.
We've assembled an incredible cast and crew that's going to bring you in high definition some of the most beautiful waterways, dangerous waterways in North America.
The cast of Dangerous Waters Productions and their four sea-doos planned on filming several days on the Stikine River and LeConte Bay south of Petersburg before heading north to Haines and Glacier Bay. After that, they plan to transport the skis to Anchorage and then make stops in Dutch Harbor, King Salmon, Nome, and hope to eventually make a run across the Bering Strait to Russia. In Petersburg, I'm Joe Vicnicki.
The Jet Ski Show is scheduled to air on HDNet sometime in the spring of 2012. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Alexandra Gutierrez in Unalaska, Len Anderson in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Casey Kelly in Juneau, Deanna Garrison in Ketchikan, and Joe Vicnicki in Petersburg. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the Center for Distance Education at UAF, offering access to online courses from any location. Information at distance.uaf.edu/learn.
Timing is everything. A mother who waits until her child is at least 2 years old before becoming pregnant again is making the best decision for herself and her baby. The mother has a better chance of regaining health and energy between pregnancies, and her baby has a better chance of being born on time and at a good weight. Talk to your health care provider to find out how to plan your pregnancies. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.